Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime.
How are you doing?
Good. It's good to see you again.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, remember our merch closes at the end of the summer.
Yes, August, right?
August. So, yeah, end of August. Yeah. We'll get you a date. We haven't decided yet. We're gonna talk about it. We'll get you a date. Yeah, so check it out. Might I recommend the t-shirts? They're the best way to, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know, show your love for us.
I happen to really like my t-shirt.
Yeah. I love my tie-dye one.
Yeah. So. I got the black one just because, you know, I like black clothes.
Yeah. And it really pops on the black. Yeah. Really pops. Mm-hmm. Okay, Lena. What do you think about public toilets?
They're gross to me, but when you have to go, you have to go.
When you have to go, you have to go. I mean, my friend Dusty, like, she has almost an anxiety attack when she has to use a public toilet. Here's my thoughts about public toilets.
Mm-hmm.
Automatic flushing, why is it in some toilets and not in others? Mm-hmm. Do you ever, like, pee and then get up and you start to walk out and be like, oh, I have to flush it?
Yeah, yeah.
I do that a lot. Also...
Keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, it does. It makes you really have to pay attention to your surroundings. Talking about a toilet. And the automatic flush really scares Hazel. She does not like... Oh. Like, she does not like... She has, like, sensory... sensitivity. Okay. So she hates
but I
it.
Think that's a lot of kids, honestly.
Yeah.
I had a niece that would never flush the toilet when she was little. Mm-hmm. She would just walk out and just leave
presents
it
because, for everybody.
Yeah, because she didn't like the loud flushing.
Yeah, no, I feel that. Also, toilet seat covers. Not enough toilet seat covers in public restrooms.
Yeah, agreed.
I got these really cute toilet seat covers for Hazel. The hole is smaller than like a public bathroom toilet seat cover. And it actually covers the sides of the toilet. Because, you know, their little legs dangle.
Yeah.
So it, you know, because when she first was potty trained, she would sit on a public toilet and feel like she was going to fall in.
Yeah.
But
and
this
hold on
one,
to the side.
Yes, but this one actually you can, it has little adhesives. You can peel off the strips and it sticks to the side so it doesn't like come off.
That's really cool. And,
yeah, it really is. I got them on Amazon. Not sponsored, by the way, but, you know, sliding to
just helping
DMs
another mama out.
Yeah, exactly. And hey, I used it one time because they didn't have any toilet seat covers in there. And I was like... hey, I've got one of those in my bag. I'm going to use it. So, anyway, I just thought I would break the ice a little bit by talking about
it. Good conversation.
Toilets. but let's talk about another toilet. Murder. The case I have for you today is a really messy one. Like... real messy, like a toilet, like a public bathroom. So Sherelle Margaret Dell was just 17 when she met and married her husband, Scott Dell, and he was just 19.
Oh.
I don't know Sherelle's maiden name. Couldn't find anything about her childhood or anything, but it doesn't matter. Trust me, we don't need to know anything more about her than we do. They settled in Killaloe. My Canadian friends are going to ream me for this if I'm not pronouncing that right. But Killaloe, Ontario, Canada, which was an interesting place, by all accounts. It was kind of made up of farms, and a lot of people lived off the grid. It's kind of in the mountains. They were kind of known as hippies. But it was a great place to raise a family, and everyone knew everyone, and everyone knew everyone's business. So their relationship wasn't great from the start. I mean, they were a couple of kids getting married, so how mature could it have been? But there was something there because they stuck it out for a really long time, and Scott adored Sherelle. Now, Sherelle was, like I said, kind of a hippie, kind of new agey. She had witchcraft books and was fascinated with, you know, voodoo dolls and seances and just, you know, she just liked to be dabbling in all sorts of stuff.
That's no good,
you know,
just
weird things. Now, she had this long, dark red hair that would change frequently. She was always experimenting with different colors. She was very pretty. So she stood out in a crowd. She had, like, very beautiful, perfect milky skin. People would describe her as looking like a porcelain doll. Now, Sherelle's neighbors and acquaintances described her as a bit extra. Everything with her was like an elaborate production. The stuff of soap operas, if you will.
Oh, goodness.
She always had some over-the-top story, and she'd tell it in a very in-your-face type of way. Like, she'd get really in your face and, like, get really into it. And she'd dress up in a fur coat and high heels just to go run errands. Like, just to go down to the store, grab some milk. She was just a little over-the-top. Scott, on the other hand, was the polar opposite. He was soft-spoken, he was intelligent, his friends said he was an attractive person, not just physically, but he had this aura about him that kind of drew you in. He was caring and passionate in the relationships that he had. Like, when he loved hard. And he loved Sherelle. According to the book Strip and Kill, the true crime story of Sherelle Dell, he was further described as an amazing father, and despite her many extramarital affairs, Scott always had taken her back. Like I said, he really just loved her.
Poor guy.
Just a little side note about the title of that book, Strip and Kill. Sherelle Dell had worked as a stripper in her past, and I didn't include that in the story because it's not really relevant. I think the media tries to grasp at things, you know, just like, oh, she's a stripper.
But it adds to the person that,
I guess.
I mean.
Well, there's a lot of other things about her that the stripper is, like,
minute.
It is, makes her look like a saint. I mean.
Oh, Lord.
You know, be a stripper if you want. I don't care, but. There's so many other things about her that are noteworthy.
Oh, gosh.
So I just didn't include that. But that's the name of the book. In the early 1990s, Scott had been diagnosed with throat cancer, but he got better. And he didn't go around telling people, oh, you know, I just had cancer. That's, you know, why, and he didn't tell anybody about his health battles. He just got on with life. He was grateful to have beat it and grateful to be alive and thriving and everything else. They did have children together. There was some reports of one of them was adopted. I saw reports that they had three. I saw reports that they had two. They had children. Again, I mention that because it's important to know that children were involved in this mess, but obviously not relevant to the story at hand. So,
okay.
They separated in 1992, and Sherelle was free to hit the town. Let's be honest, she had been hitting the town multiple times in their marriage, but this time it was legit. She felt free to do so. She met a woman named Gay Doherty at an incest survivor group. And what began as a casual relationship soon turned into something more. They began spending all of their time together. That was a very loaded sentence, I know.
Yeah.
An incest survivor group. I told you this was messy.
So, yeah, I mean, obviously, this may have been where all of her hurts and...
Yeah, I wish I knew more about her childhood and what she went through, but I don't. And, you know, I think when you become an adult, those things...
You have a choice.
You have a choice. You have a choice. But Gay grew tired of Sherelle after a while. She felt a little smothered by her affection. I think I was watching an interview. One of Sherelle's former friends had said that Sherelle was the type of person that she would find vulnerable people to exploit and give them what they wanted the most, which was attention. She found Gay to be vulnerable in this way, and she smothered her with attention. And at first, Gay really latched onto that, but then she was like, no, this isn't for me. And I don't think there was just that one thing. The Strip and Kill book said that Gay felt stifled, but I think there was so much more about Sherelle to grow tired of. She just wasn't a nice person. Their breakup was messy, but as time went on, they remained in contact. They actually stayed friends, and she would come to visit Sherelle's children because they had become important to her. And, they even continued to communicate after Sherelle began dating another woman named Nancy Fillmore, who was her children's nanny. Now, I saw in one report that she was the nanny, but I didn't see it anywhere else. But the next bit of my notes say that Nancy had a lot of money. I don't know why she was working as a nanny if she had a lot of
money.
Just
to have something to do, maybe?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how she had this money, but... Nancy had money, and Sherelle wanted to buy a house, so she saw this opportunity here. Her and Nancy struck up this relationship, and Nancy gave her a hefty down payment on a house that they were going to buy and live in together and live happily ever after. Okay. So just like Sherelle's relationship with Gay, her relationship with Nancy was moving really fast. Now, Nancy's friends were like, I hope you're making sure that your name is on that deed. And she's like, oh, no, you know, Sherelle's taking care of it. Oh, no. Everything's on the up and up. It's fine. Whatever. Some sources referred to the place that they shared as an apartment. So I'm not sure if they shared an apartment before they got a house or if this house was like an apartment or condo type of thing. Like a, you know what I mean?
Condo
like
or if town they bought. Or...
Yeah, exactly. It was unclear, but I thought I'd just note that. Now, Scott continued to make several attempts to win Sherelle back during the time that they were separated. I mean, he loved her. That was his wife. They were still married all those years. Oh. They were still married. They never divorced. They were just separated, and she was just dating all these other people. And this infuriated Nancy. He was always coming over to see their children. I mean, those were his children. And so he would have to drop them off, pick them up, you know, your typical custody, you know, exchanging the children. But he would like linger. He would hang around. He would go get himself a water in the kitchen. And Nancy just hated that he was that involved
in,
you know,
her space.
Exactly. And Sherelle was like, Nancy, listen, he's gonna be dead soon, so you don't need to worry about him much longer.
Okay.
Because his cancer's back. So she was like, you know, just let him live, let him, you know, hang around and just let it go. So December 29th, 1995, Scott cracked open a bottle of Pedro. wine. My French teacher, if she's listening, hey, Kathy, how you doing? she is going to be very disappointed.
Oh, no.
So he cracked open this bottle of wine that Sherelle had given him, turned on some music, and gave her a call. He was feeling sentimental. So they talked and talked for hours. I saw one report that said they talked for 9 hours.
What in the world?
Lena, we used to talk for hours on the phone, but nine hours?
Whoa.
I don't think we ever talked for 9 hours.
No.
I know we used to watch movies together, like on the phone. Do you remember that?
I do remember that.
I don't know why, when we just lived across the street, maybe I was grounded. I don't know.
We just missed each other. Okay?
I know. So Scott wanted to reconcile with his wife. There was no secret about that. He still loved her very much. And for the first time in a while, as he's talking to her, she was returning the sentiment. You know, the more they talked, the more he drank glass after glass, and he was starting to feel really excited because they were discussing the future. As he slipped further and further into his feels, he was making notes on this paper. Thoughts, really. More like ramblings. Things like, quote, I feel like holding you close to me like never before. I feel like making love to you. I feel like all of the bad stuff would go away. End quote. And, quote, what do you think was going to happen if I drink a bottle of wine listening to music we used to listen to? I'm going to think about you and me together, end quote. And the more he drank, the notes started to make less and less sense. Okay. And he'd write things like, quote, I can't help it. I don't want to want you. I don't want to be rejected. If we don't get back together, we maybe shouldn't see each other very much. End quote. So he was going through it. Mm-hmm. So by about 4 a.m., they finally wrapped up this conversation because, you know, he's still drinking at this point. His speech is slurring. He's dozing off. And he told Sherelle that he was having visions of her as an angel. So she told him, my angel spirit will take you to heaven. And with that,
even though she's like into witchcraft, like yeah, that's exactly. Like a different spectrum.
I know. She was into all sorts of things. She probably was, you know, just into all sorts of
confused.
Things. Confused. Yeah, exactly. Very confused. So with that, he hung up the phone. He went up to stairs to go to bed, and he didn't make it to bed. He just kind of passed out on the floor instead.
Oh.
So, Gay Doherty, Sherelle's ex, was in town to visit Sherelle and her kids. It was Christmas time, so she wanted to come by, see how they were doing. And Sherelle was pretty much on the phone the whole night, and that was the night she was on the phone with Scott.
Oh.
So, Gay was like, this is fun. Real fun. I'm gonna go.
Yeah.
So, she left. And when she came back the following day, Sherelle was like, well, you know, Scott didn't pick up the kids this morning, so I don't know what he's up to. And Gay said, well, I'll just go over and check on him. Scott lived in a farmhouse pretty close by, so she went over there. When she got to the house, all the lights were on. It was the morning. The Christmas tree was still twinkling in the window. So she was like, I don't think he would turn on his tree. Like,
yeah,
during like in the morning, you know, maybe it was he left it on all night. And as she approached the door, she could hear music playing. And she was like, there was no answer when she knocked. She called out to Scott, and this made her feel really weird. Like, she started to feel really, she just got this inkling that something wasn't right. So she went back to Sherelle's house and was like, she told her and Nancy, because Nancy was living there. And she told them, y'all need to come with me to go back to his house because something's not right. And they were like, no, no. And I'm sure Gay felt like this was strange, but Sherelle said, I can't cope if something's wrong with him. Like, if something's happened to him, because she was saying, you know, his cancer's back and he was dying. And if he's dead or something, I can't see that. Like, I just can't. So Gay rounded up a couple of guy friends to accompany her back to Scott's house. So they went back.
Was there not a police department anywhere?
You know, that wasn't brought up. I think it was just like, well, I'm not going back by myself. You know, I think she just didn't want to make a big deal just yet.
Mm-hmm.
So they made entry into the home when they got there. No report said whether or not, like, the house was unlocked or whatever, but they got in somehow. They walked in and she called out to him, "Scott, are you here?" You know, the music's still playing. How freaky.
Yeah.
She looked around downstairs and nothing. She saw the wine. She was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
He had a time last night. So she fully expected to go upstairs, find him still lying in bed, potentially recovering from that hours-long phone call he had with Sherelle the night before. Instead, she found him laying on the floor, surrounded by a pile of his own vomit.
Oh, no.
And at just 44 years of age, he was dead. So police were obviously called to the scene. They were really unsure what to think because there was no obvious signs of trauma to Scott's body and nothing at the scene to indicate that, like, what may have happened or maybe he was attacked. Nothing like that. No signs of break-in or murder or anything like that. So they just weren't sure what to think. But they did find a few sheets of paper with those rambling thoughts on them.
Yeah.
And they began to think Scott may have been in distress because he, you know, those things sounded kind of sad. Mm-hmm. Now, they naturally wanted to speak with his estranged wife to get some sort of insight into Scott's demeanor in the days or weeks leading up to his death. She explained that he'd been diagnosed with throat cancer years prior and that it had recently returned. And this time, it was a death sentence. Like, he was going to die from it, and he wasn't going to get better. And she said, basically, he was going to die any day, and he was really depressed about that, and he probably killed himself so he didn't have to deteriorate from the cancer. Now, this did make some sense to police, you know, that the sentiments expressed in the notes did kind of feel like the thoughts of someone considering ending their life.
Right.
Scott's family says, not too sure about that. And they immediately grew suspicious of his death. I mean, he was sprightly. He was fine. He didn't seem sick. He didn't seem ailing. And he didn't tell them that his cancer had returned. So they were what? This is news to us. So they begged authorities to perform an autopsy. But investigators said, I'm so sorry. The coroner had already ruled his death a suicide, and his body was sent to the crematorium.
No.
Yeah. Their stomachs dropped.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But what that investigator didn't realize was that, you know, that awkward time between Christmas and New Year's where everything's closed? The crematorium was closed. So his body had not been cremated yet.
Wow.
Yes. So the autopsy was on, and what it revealed was not what authorities expected to find.
Ooh.
That bottle of wine he was drinking, it wasn't just wine. Toxicology found that Scott Dell had high levels of ethylene glycol in his system.
Oh, really?
3 times the amount that it would have taken to kill him, or anyone else for that matter. I'm sure if you're a true crime junkie, you've heard about people who die from ethylene glycol, aka antifreeze poisoning. It's sweet, so it's easily masked in foods or drinks. But someone who consumes antifreeze would become very acidic. Their breathing would become rapid, and eventually their heart and lungs would cease to function. And looking back, Gay realized that that oily substance she saw in Scott's wine glass that morning that she found his body, was antifreeze. She recounted that it didn't look like wine because it had a different texture than wine. She could tell. Oh, wow. And it was like bright green. She's like, I've never seen a wine that color before.
Well, that was a good observation.
Yeah. So, but it didn't mean anything to her at the time, but now it did. So yeah. Now you might be thinking, just because he had antifreeze in his wine doesn't mean he did not do this to himself. Like, yeah, he still very well, exactly, could have done this to himself. Maybe he was depressed about the cancer and took his life in this way, and police might have agreed with you, except for one thing, Lena. Mm-hmm. There was just one more thing that autopsy revealed.
Uh-oh.
Scott did not have cancer in his body at all.
Interesting.
Now this suicide theory isn't looking so plausible, yeah, is it?
There's a lie somewhere.
Mm-hmm. As my mother says, you lie, you fry. So what about that 3-page note, though, with those incomprehensible ramblings? Seemed like he wasn't in a good headspace, and the police felt like it was the makings of a suicide note.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know that phone call, that 9-hour phone call between Scott and Sherelle?
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that in that call, Sherelle was telling Scott to write down all of his feelings. All the things that he was saying to her, write them down. Oh, you want to make love to me? Write it down. You think about us getting back together? Be specific and write it down.
Girl.
It might seem silly to most, but her request felt genuine to him. She was telling him things like she wanted to get back together with him, and he was going to do anything to impress her. That is
so disgusting.
Isn't it gross?
Yeah.
So they learned this and more from none other than Sherelle's ex-scorned lover, Nancy Fillmore.
Okay.
I said ex, and I said you scorned. Did say. Now, in 1997, 2 years after Scott's death, Nancy had reluctantly gone to detectives with some very saucy information. She and Sherelle's relationship had irreparably deteriorated in March of 1997, and the fing claws were out.
Mm-hmm.
Nancy had reported Sherelle's poor parenting to family services, claiming that she wasn't feeding her children, she was locking up the food, neglecting the pets. Listen, in her defense, my kids get into the pantry all the time, and like, they could seriously get hurt if canned foods fell on them, you know?
Well, yeah.
Anyway, I'm just saying I've considered putting a lock on my pantry. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, back to the story. Well, when child services went out to look at the house, they were like, she's feeding her kids. There's no locks. I don't see anything of that nature. So you just mad, you know? You just mad, yeah. Honey. But Nancy, she had one more card to play. Mm-hmm. One more card. And it was an ace. The truth about Scott Dell's death.
Oh, she knows the truth.
She claimed that she knows Scott didn't kill himself because it was Sherelle who put the antifreeze in the wine that she gifted to Scott.
She gifted it to him.
Yep. Not only that, but Nancy says she was at Scott's house the night he died. You see, at the behest of Sherelle, she was sent there to make sure everything went according to plan.
Oh, so she was a part of the plan.
Mm-hmm. She knew what was going on. So, in this interview with police, Nancy also revealed more disturbing details about Sherelle. Apparently, Sherelle really wanted a baby, and she had told her children that they had a baby brother living in Jamaica with his father, he was even named some like Bougie or something.
What?
And the children believed that they had a little brother in Jamaica. There was no baby in Jamaica. I mean, there was babies in Jamaica, but not her baby.
Oh, so she planned on adopting a child from Jamaica and saying it was her biological.
No, Lena, she didn't plan on adopting a child in Jamaica. She was just pretending she had a baby because she was a psycho. She just really wanted a baby. And she even came up with preliminary kidnapping plans, if you will. Plans that she had devised in order to steal a stranger's baby and raise it as her own. But she did not get that chance to go through with that, thank God, because Sherelle was arrested for the murder of her husband, Scott.
Good job, Nancy, for bringing out the truth.
Yep. So let's talk about the trial that began in Pembroke, Ontario in November of 2000. You know, when I hear the year 2000, I'm like, wow, that wasn't that long ago, but it actually was that long ago.
It was. Oh, that's sad.
It's so sad. Now, the Crown presented about 50 witnesses to speak to Sherelle's miserable existence. Yeah.
Ooh.
And they told the court how she was conniving, vindictive, manipulative, and she would do anything to swindle people out of money. It was always something. It was, I need groceries, or, I can't feed my kids. And she just always getting money from people. And she wasn't afraid to play the long game, like she was doing with Nancy, for instance, you know? Well, one key person was absent from that witness list at trial. Someone who was supposed to be the star witness in the case against Sherelle. That was Nancy Fillmore.
Uh-oh.
Because she died in a house fire in August of 1997.
Okay.
I'm sorry for my outburst. Yeah, just before Sherelle was arrested, Nancy died in a house fire. Good luck for Sherelle, though, right? Like,
well, yeah, sounds like it.
You know what I say, Lena? I say you make your own luck. So, well, Scott's murder.
I think Sherelle was doing that, yeah.
Well, right away, the defense kind of won some key arguments. Nancy's recorded interviews with police were deemed inadmissible because they were determined to be unreliable. Nancy was scorned. She had given some really damning statements about Sherelle's character. And as we know, judges often do not let statements of character in because it's prejudicial. In the Murdoch trial, I mean, we were constantly hearing the probative versus prejudicial argument, and the fact remains that hearing about someone's poor parenting or other misdeeds could largely influence a verdict.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, they were that bad of a person? Then they must be a murderer.
Right.
So Nancy wasn't there to testify, and likewise, the things she said were not able to be considered.
That is
luckily,
so stupid.
There were other people happy to tell the court about Sherelle's destructive nature.
Wow.
So during trial, Sherelle's oldest daughter testified that just months before her dad died, her mom's cat lapped up some antifreeze that had spilled in the garage. And she freaked out. She called the emergency vet and said, is my cat going to be okay? Like, how much antifreeze would it take to kill my cat? And then her daughter went on to say that her mother was growing very quiet in the conversation, and she overheard her mother say, and just out of curiosity, how much antifreeze does it take to kill a human? Can you imagine being witness to that conversation?
Oh my gosh.
I mean, what? She went on to say that after her father's death, she heard her mom and her mom's lover, Nancy Fillmore, talking about the night her dad died. And her mother said something about sending Gay over there to Scott's house, knowing what she would find.
Right.
So that didn't make sense to her at the time. Like, these are conversations she recalled that now are clicking, you know?
Right. And how do you know how old her oldest daughter was when she had to get on the witness stand?
Yes, she was 24.
Oh.
Yes, she was 24. And I won't share her name because, you know, the court didn't share her name. Yeah. But she described what a terrible mother Sherelle was. She actually considered Scott her father her whole life, but he wasn't her biological father.
Oh.
Her biological father was someone her mother had had a fling with.
Okay.
I don't know if she knew who her dad was or if she didn't know, but Scott was very much her father her whole life. She was also pulled from public school to be homeschooled, but her mother sucked at that too.
Yeah.
And sadly, like I said, she was 24 now. She couldn't read very well.
Hmm.
Truth be told, she wasn't pulled from public school to learn at home. Her mother wanted her to do the housework and raise her siblings.
Control over her. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And if that wasn't bad enough, Sherelle claimed that Scott had sexually abused their daughter.
Oh, no.
And she made her go along with it.
Oh, no.
She manipulated her into lying and going along with this disgusting accusation.
Oh, I'm so sorry she went through that.
Yeah. Now, the defense maintained that the police got it right the first time. Scott killed himself. He was depressed. Mm-hmm. You know, he made his own lethal cocktail, knowing exactly what was in it. And there was no evidence to prove that Sherelle had been the one to make the wine concoction. But as we know, no cancer was found in Scott's autopsy. So what else could have been the motive for suicide? Well, right. The answer is nothing. Because Scott did not take his own life. And right. Superior Court Judge Ames Chadwick, sorry guy, he was not picking up what the defense was putting down. Circumstantial as the case may have been, because let's be honest, it was. The truth prevailed. And in January of 2001, the judge found Sherelle guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced her booty to life in prison. With the chance of parole in 25 years. You know those Canadians are softies. Those Canadians. Now, you know I said earlier, you make your own luck.
You did say that.
I said it. Well, I meant that Nancy's death before Sherelle's trial wasn't luck at all. She too was murdered.
Okay, how'd they come up with this?
So, just before... just months before Sherelle was arrested for Scott's murder, a 16-year-old boy named, yes, I said boy, named Brent Crawford was smoking marijuana with Sherelle and agreed to kill Nancy for a payment of $300 and a motorcycle.
Oh, wow.
Ah, to be 16 again.
No, thank you.
I mean, ay, ay, ay. Now, Brent said that he went over to Nancy's to kill her, but he found her passed out. She was, like, passed out, and she had lit candles nearby, so he just went, whoopsie, right. And knocked over the candles and left.
Wow.
I think for him, he felt like he wasn't really killing her. He was just, you know.
Oh, she'll get out.
Setting the scene. But Sherelle claimed that... she just wanted Brent to go over and scare Nancy. She never, ever asked him nor expected him to murder her.
Of course not.
Well, both Brent and Sherelle were charged with the first-degree murder of Nancy Fillmore. But before she could go to trial for that murder, Sherelle pled to a lesser charge of intimidation.
No, ma'am.
So, nowhere near a murder charge. I told you, those Canadians are softies.
No.
Now, Brent, however, now 19 years old, was found guilty of first-degree murder. I couldn't find information on his sentence. I'm not sure if they took into account that he was... I don't know if 16 is a juvenile in Canada. But I'm not sure. I couldn't find any information as to his sentence, but... oof. Now, in 2005, Sherelle lost an appeal. According to Cheryl's attorney, Cheryl, whatever your name is, psycho. According to her attorney, Jeff Schroeder, it's 9:30, guys, 9:30 p.m. She filed a faint hope application in July of 2013 to grant her early parole, and that would actually allow her to get in line to get out on parole. It doesn't actually mean once she's granted early parole, they just open the door and she leaves. So if the application were granted, she would be offered escorted and unescorted and work release passes from prison. That would eventually...
Oh, gosh.
Eventually full parole. It's kind of like, okay, if you can behave yourself today and go to Walmart, you know, and buy some milk then come right back to prison, we will consider letting you out.
No, I mean, I appreciate the idea, but you have
those softies over there, up there. Sorry. But the Ottawa Citizen reported that in 2016, Cheryl would continue to sit her booty in prison because I'm sorry, guys. Hang on. It's almost over.
You need to go night-night.
Ontario Superior Court Justice Robert Merringer said she failed to meet requirements for early release because she, quote, pathologically lied about her life story and, quote, has an inability to tell the truth with her persistent misrepresentations. And I say I agree, sir. So that was denied. And she was actually able to apply for parole again in 2022, which was just last year. But I couldn't find any information about her doing so. And as we know, the court systems, you know, those things take a long time. But that was the last report, was that she was able to file, if I know Cheryl, and I think I do. she did apply or will be applying. So,
it's in the works.
It's in the works. And hopefully we'll have some information about that at some point.
Give it up,
I know you guys are just going to be sitting on the edge of your seats wondering, but, that's the weird, wild, messy, weird case of Cheryl Dell. And her, the destruction that she caused. Yeah, very gross. I feel gross. Probably going to need a shower. So that's it.
Thanks for telling that story of Scott and Nancy, because
I don't care
about Cheryl, but the other two. Cheryl. Rest in peace, yes.
Ew, my name's Cheryl. I wear a fur coat to Publix. Okay, Cheryl, whatever.
Yeah.
All right, guys. All right. Thanks for listening.
That was great. Let's do it again.
Let's do it again. We'll see you next week, guys. Bye, y'all.
Well, thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying our podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating so that other true crime fans can find us.
If you have any case suggestions or just want to say hey, email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, where we post case photos and information at Cousins on Crime Podcast.